Hey friends, just quickly, my new book, The Proof is in the Plants, is now available. Get it from plantproof.com/book. Thanks so much for all your ongoing support, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
When we look at actual outcomes, the actual strength gains or muscle gains, which is really what we care about when it comes to performance, we actually don't see a difference between animal and plant protein when you're equating the amount of protein, ideally meeting that threshold of 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight, and of course, equating leucine. When you've taken care of those issues, there really is no difference. And we have a meta-analysis by Mark Messina actually looking at soy protein and comparing it to whey protein or other animal proteins, and there is no difference. There's not even a suggested difference between the two. It's pretty well identical. Based on the data we have for either rice protein powders or pea protein powders, it's the same deal. When you're having the same amount of protein, there just doesn't seem to be any kind of difference. There are no issue building the same amount of strength or muscle mass.
That's Dr. Matthew Nagra. And this is episode 133 of the Plant Proof Podcast. Hi friends, here we go. We meet again. Welcome back. I hope you're doing well. And for any of the first time listeners out there, welcome. It's great to have you join us. I'm Simon Hill, your show host, author, nutritionist, and physiotherapist. Today's episode with Dr. Matthew Nagra is all about protein. I remember over 6 years ago when I finally made the decision to transition to a plant-based approach, I had a lot of questions about protein. While at this time, I knew that I needed to cut back on my animal protein intake if I wanted to lower my risk of cardiovascular disease and other chronic diseases, I was at the same time very apprehensive in cutting back on foods like meat and eggs because I worried about my strength, overall physical performance, my physique, etc. And I'll never forget that apprehension. And to this day, I use that to help remind me how difficult it can be, especially for males, to break away from the cultural norm, a diet that sees meat as the hero of the plate and meat as muscle. This is the episode that I wish I had when I was embarking on my transition. What is protein? Why is it important? How much do we need? The difference between animal and plant protein when it comes to our health. Is plant protein complete? Is it digestible? What about working out and building muscle? Does protein source matter? Is soy protein safe? In this episode, we cover all of this and more. Importantly, we cover all of these questions from an evidence-based lens. Forget what's on social media. What does science tell us? Because that's the way we like to do things around here, right? I thought so. With that said, this is Dr. Matthew Nagra and myself talking all things protein. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll catch you on the other side. Hey, Dr. Nagra, welcome back to the show. It's always a great pleasure to have you with us. You're a huge favorite, certainly, with the community.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me on again.
Before we dive into this episode, which is on protein, tell me, I know that you love to stay right on top of the research and are always looking at new papers that are published. Is there any specific study that's been recently published on any nutrition topic that you think would be interesting for the community to hear about?
Yes, actually. So last time we spoke, the Epic Oxford study looking at fracture risk in vegans and vegetarians had just been published. And obviously it was being picked up by a lot of media outlets, a lot of the low-carb animal-based sort of community. Well, just recently, we actually had a new publication from the Adventist Health Study too. And this looked at fracture risk in, again, vegans, vegetarians, pescatarians, semi-vegetarians, and non-vegetarians in the Adventist cohorts throughout both Canada and the US. And contrary to that Epic Oxford study, this one actually didn't find a statistically significant risk of fracture overall, but there was a higher risk of fracture in the vegan women in particular. But what's really interesting about this study was when they adjusted for both calcium and vitamin D supplementation, the risk was gone altogether. And I do want to note that there was no risk in men at all, again, similar to what we did see in that Epic Oxford study. So it really just goes to show that when we look at a healthy population of vegans, which is what the Adventist cohort is, and we're looking at those making sure that they are, of course, hitting their calcium and vitamin D needs, we just don't really see risk there. And if anything, they're actually trended towards benefit after that, a lower risk compared to the meat eaters that were supplementing.
Okay, great. So in terms of looking at that study with all the other literature that we have on building strong bones, where does that leave you in terms of take-home message, practical points for someone in terms of making sure that their diet and lifestyle is adequately planned for building strong bones?
For diet alone, obviously you want to make sure you're eating enough, that you're not underweight, which is a big point from the previous publication, from the Epic Oxford publication. But here, it just really emphasizes the point, you want to be making sure you're getting enough calcium. Now, that can be done through supplementation. It can also be done through consuming fortified foods. That's where I get my calcium. I know that's where you get a lot of yours. Obviously, fortified plant milks are fantastic. Or, of course, tofu, calcium-set tofu can be great, as well as unfortified foods like dark leafy greens and whatnot. But then, you know, vitamin D supplementation may be pertinent depending on where you live, right? I live in Canada and it is typically recommended for most people here to be supplementing, especially as we age. So that just is another take-home point there.
And then in terms of lifestyle, that resistance, some form of resistance exercise.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, great. So in this episode, we are going to tackle protein. And really, I think the aim here is, from my end, I'd like this to be the episode that I wish I could have listened to 6+ years ago when I was changing my diet. And like many of us, I had many beliefs about protein that weren't necessarily based on science. They were what I had picked up from magazines and in the gym and in the football culture that I was surrounded by. And it took me some time to challenge those ideas and then eventually modify my diet and have confidence in doing so. And specifically, some of the things that I was thinking about at this time was, can I get adequate amounts of protein from plants? And then, of course, is the type of protein in plants the same as that of what's found in animal products? And is the plant protein as digestible? Is my body going to be able to use it, to utilize it, the protein from beans as well as the protein from beef, for example? And then ultimately, will I be able to continue to build lean muscle and strength without eating animal protein? This was all of the things that I was thinking about that I know is very common. These are very valid questions and ideas that people have as a result of living in the society that we've grown up in. So I think we sort of step through these questions and perhaps the best place to start with this, Matt, is right from the beginning with a bit of an overview, a definition of what protein is.
Yeah, so protein is made up of amino acids. So these are the building blocks of proteins. It's often described as sort of beads on a string, right? You attach all the beads along the string and it forms a protein. And proteins are used for all sorts of things. They're used obviously for muscle. They're used for other connective tissues, tendons, ligaments. They're used for bone tissue. They're used for enzymes within our body. They're used for a variety of things. They're incredibly important to our overall body structures and functions. In a more traditional sense, protein is thought of as one of the three main macronutrients, and it is. There are carbs, fats, and protein. Those are the three places that we get most of our calories from. Now, you can also get calories from alcohol, but we don't want to be using that as a majority of our caloric intake, of course. But carbohydrates provide 4 calories or kilocalories to be more specific of energy per gram. Fats provide 9 kilocalories. And then protein provides 4 kilocalories as well, same as carbs. So fats are the most energy dense of those. We can talk about a little bit as we go on here about different ratios of the carbs to fats and proteins and all of that, which I'm sure we'll get into. But ultimately, that I think is a pretty decent description of what exactly proteins are.
Okay. And different proteins, as you say, have a different chain of these amino acids. And we'll explore amino acids a little more when we talk about perhaps some of the differences between animal and plant protein in terms of their makeup. Before we do that, why is protein important? Why is it important that we're consuming enough protein in the first place?
Well, I mean, like I already said, protein is important for so many different functions and structures within the body. But if you look at, say, developing nations, protein deficiency is actually a real problem in those parts of the world. Proteins are also used to maintain solute concentrations in our bloodstream. And if you're too low there, you can end up with this sort of bloating and water weight. And there's a condition called kwashiorkor out there. Also, as we age, we tend to lose some muscle mass. And that is a normal part of aging. But you can also lose too much muscle mass too rapidly. And that's called sarcopenia. So that's actually a condition that we can deal with as we age. Protein is also the most satiating or the most filling of the 3 main macronutrients. And of course, for athletic endeavors, I know you're an athlete, I'm an athlete as well, and I want to make sure I'm performing at my best. So making sure I'm getting adequate protein in that respect is important. Of course, there are 2 big camps that we could mention here. There's the camp of people that we do see sometimes in the plant-based space saying, oh, protein doesn't matter at all, don't worry about it. And I kind of get where they're coming from. I do get that there is maybe a bit too much focus on protein in some ways, as kind of being the be-all, end-all. But at the same time, we don't want to downplay its importance, particularly in those populations that do stand to benefit, like athletes, like elderly individuals, growing children, and so on. But then there are, like I said, those people who think that protein is everything and it's all that we need to worry about. It's the only thing we need to count in our diet. And that also can become an issue.
Yeah, when you look at how much we need and how much the average person is getting, it does demonstrate that we, to a degree, do have an obsession with protein. And when we are hyper-focusing on it, it can be somewhat of a distraction from other areas of our diet where we're not doing so well. So I think maybe we speak to that. What is the amount of protein that we require and how much is the average person consuming?
Yeah, I mean, the RDA, so the recommended intake for protein is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of your body weight. So obviously, it's going to depend on how much you weigh personally, how much lean mass in particular that you may have. But on average, that works out to about 56 grams for a sedentary male and 46 grams for a sedentary female. So for people who aren't overly active or aren't very active at all, really, that is the standard recommendation. And it's important to note that that's based on meeting the needs for the majority of people if they were, again, sedentary, kind of average weight, average height, and all of that. Now, needs do go up, like I said, in certain cases. There aren't necessarily really solid recommended intakes for each of these groups, but we can make pretty good assumptions based on the data that's available. For pregnancy, usually it's around 1.1 grams per kilogram. A body weight for endurance athletes, anywhere from 1.2 to 1.4. For strength athletes, it seems to peak at about 1.6 grams per kilogram. So that's actually double the standard recommendation. For elderly, it's probably in the ballpark of 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. And that's based on recommendations from the Prot Age Study Group and the European Society for Clinical Nutrition and Metabolism. But they actually recommend higher intakes for those with sarcopenia. So again, for those people with that sort of muscle wasting as they're aging, they want to jack it up a little bit more to 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram. To contrast what I mentioned before about that sort of base recommendation of, say, 56 grams for males and 46 for females, well, the average intake based on Chris Gardner's 2019 paper that you're going to, of course, link in the show notes, using data from the National Health, Nutrition, and Examination Survey, the FAO, WHO, USDA, They found that Americans are consuming roughly 90 to 100 grams of protein per day, of which 70 to 85% is from animal sources. So just let that sink in. They're basically doubling what they need to be consuming, or almost doubling what they need to be consuming. And the vast majority of that is coming from animal sources.
And it's important to note that that's double the RDA. And that RDA, as you said before, is actually designed to cover 97.5% of the population. In order to determine the RDA, they look at the curve and they look at the average, and then they move two standard deviations to the right, increase it by two standard deviations. So there already is a buffer in place just in that RDA for many people within the population. And then, as you just said then, based on the data we have from Chris Gardner's 2019 paper, people are consuming nearly double that. So protein quantity doesn't seem to be an issue. Now, we're talking here about the average person. What could be interesting to explore here is different dietary patterns, because people may be wondering, well, the average person is probably adopting an omnivorous diet with animal and plant foods. What about populations that are not consuming animal-based foods? Are they still consuming adequate amounts of protein?
Yeah, well, I have yet to really see a publication showing, you know, vegan populations, eating strictly plants who are under-eating protein. We do have data from, again, the Adventist Health Study 2, and these are, of course, more health-conscious individuals. And they actually found that if you assume everybody in the study was around average height and you take their body mass index and, of course, calculate out their weights, the vegans actually consumed more protein per body weight than the average meat eater. And the reason for that is because they need less if they weigh less. In that cohort, the vegans were actually the ones with an average healthy body mass index, whereas every other diet group sat outside the healthy range. So as body weight goes up, your needs for protein are going to go up. And that's why the meat eaters in that group did actually require more protein on a basis of per body weight protein intake. The vegans did do the best.
Okay, cool. So essentially what we've established here is that getting enough total protein does not seem to be a problem for anyone in Western populations, regardless of whether they are eating an omnivorous or a plant-based diet. That's what the data shows. The next question, though, that often arises here is usually around protein quality. And in this discussion, from my experience, two things tend to come up. One is around amino acids and the sort of complete versus incomplete proteins. And then the other is around bioavailability, sort of how digestible is that protein and how well can our body use it. Let's go through each of these in order, starting with amino acids first, and then let's look at bioavailability. What do we need to understand about the amino acid profile differences between animal and plant protein?
Yeah, so there are differences, of course. If we look at a lot of animal sources, they are going to have what you would call very balanced amino acid profiles, because you're typically eating muscle tissue, right? That it's going to not be identical to what human muscle tissue would be made of, but it does provide a pretty decent balance of the amino acids there that we would require for building things like muscle tissue. With plant sources, you do have some sources that, again, have pretty excellent amino acid profiles, but for the most part, you're going to have varying amounts of different amino acids. So you might have some plant sources that are really high in specific amino acids, like let's look at legumes, for example, typically very high in a lot of amino acids and overall protein content, but low in, say, methionine, which is one of the essential amino acids. You might have grains that are sort of the opposite, higher in other amino acids, but low in lysine. I do want to clarify that all plants contain all of the essential amino acids, but in varying amounts, as I've just described. So that's really key.
Can I interject just quickly here? Because I know we might have glossed over this. In case someone's listening and thinking, essential amino acid, non-essential, what's Matt talking about here? Can we just take one step back and then let's keep going forward?
Yeah, so there are 9 essential amino acids, and these are the amino acids that we need to consume in our diet. You know, these are the ones that we're typically worried about with regard to, you know, do plants contain all of them or do they not contain all of them? The other amino acids, we don't actually have to focus on consuming in our diet because our bodies will produce them using other amino acids. if that helps clarify there.
Okay, great. And the main point that you're making there is that those 9 essential amino acids that our body cannot make, all of them are found in all plants, just in varying proportions.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, great. So then what else do we need to understand then about amino acids? If they are in varying proportions, do we need to consider how we're constructing our meals, or what does the average person need to think about?
If you're eating at all a varied diet, I don't think it's something that needs much focus. Outside of, we will talk about leucine intake in a little bit. We'll talk about that when we get to more like muscle mass and strength gains. But for the most part, it's not something you really have to worry about unless you were really subsisting off of like one or two different foods. And this can be an issue in some parts of the world. Again, if you're living in a developing country and you only really have access to rice and very little else, yes, you might become deficient in any particular amino acid if you're just barely hitting your protein needs. For the vast majority of us, for those of us eating, you know, multiple types of foods throughout the day, it's not something to worry about. And we don't actually need to focus on combining at individual meals. I think we get too caught up in that idea of making sure you're having your rice with your beans or whatever per meal, when actually our bodies are pretty smart. They will combine amino acids at varying meals. If you have an excess of certain amino acids at breakfast, but maybe a deficiency in others, you'll combine those proteins and those amino acids with your lunch meal. And then with your dinner meal, we actually maintain some pools of amino acids in our bodies to help take care of that issue. So again, if on a daily basis, you're hitting your protein needs, you're catching all your essential amino acids, it's just not going to be a problem.
Okay, so that is a sort of old way of thinking that every meal needs to have complementary proteins. And what you're saying is that as long as over the course of a day, there's a pool of these amino acids in our body, and as long as you're consuming enough of them over that period, your body can make all of the proteins it requires. My next question for you is around these definitions, complete and incomplete, because I'm sure people have been faced with these on the internet, on the socials, or in conversations. Well, plant proteins are incomplete. And, you know, that sounds to me, when I hear that word, I automatically think missing an amino acid. And what you're saying is that they're all there. So can you kind of just shed some light on these definitions and what are the key things to understand here?
Yeah, so when people hear incomplete, they do think it's missing an amino acid altogether. That's not actually the case. What it means is that if you were just hitting your protein target, let's say you need, we'll go back to the male recommendation of 56 grams of protein per day. If you hit 56 grams of protein per day from a specific food, let's say rice, your leucine content or your leucine intake would not meet the threshold for that specific amino acid. So your total protein might hit that 56 gram mark, but your leucine intake wouldn't quite meet the recommendation for that specific amino acid. So it would be considered incomplete. That's where it actually comes from. That's sort of the simplest way I can explain it there. But again, if you're eating multiple types of foods throughout the day, it's going to be a non-issue.
So it really seems that that complete and incomplete definition is more important in a population where there is food scarcity, and perhaps someone is, through food insecurity, is living off of one particular source of food for all of their calories, as you say, which is not how most people are eating in Western developed countries, and certainly not what you and I are recommending people to do. Okay, so that's amino acids. We've covered that. The next thing that comes up is bioavailability. So it's one thing that the plants contain all the 9 essential amino acids, but how does the sort of absorption and utilization differ between these amino acids in plants versus animals?
Yeah, there's a lot about this that we can talk about as well. And there are a couple different scales or measurements often used to determine digestibility. The first one I'll talk about is called the Protein Digestibility Corrected Amino Acid Score, and that's known as PDCAS for short. And now the PDCAS basically looks at what happens when you feed often an animal like a rodent a certain protein source and how much protein comes out the other end in their fecal matter. Whatever the difference is, that's how much was supposedly absorbed. Now, there are a few issues with that. For one, we're not rodents. And like I said, it's typically done in rodents. Second, they typically, the bacteria in the colon, for example, will actually chew up some of the protein. So the measurement isn't going to be 100% accurate. And they rely on the limiting amino acid. So this is another huge issue with this, is the PDCAS score looks at the digestibility according to what I just told you, but then also specifically looks at the limiting amino acid. Again, if you were to take rice, lysine is going to be the limiting amino acid. So it's already going to show a lower score because it's not going to meet your protein needs for that limiting amino acid. So it's really up against it from the get-go.
Can I clarify something there? What you're saying with regards to limiting amino acid and the way that that scoring system is constructed goes back to what we were just saying earlier around the application of this only really mattering if someone is consuming that single food.
Yeah, exactly. And the PDCAS was really designed to look at those in developing countries as well, those with food scarcity. They want to look at what are the protein sources that are really going to provide them with enough. And if you are limited to one or two different foods, of course, that sort of a scale might be beneficial. But to correct for some of the problems with the PDCAS, there's a newer scoring system called the DAS, which is the Digestible Indispensable Amino Acid Score. In some ways, it has a similar idea. They're feeding different foods to animals, although most often pigs in this case. And instead of looking at what actually comes out in fecal matter, they'll actually insert a tube into the end of the small intestine and remove food there before it goes to the large intestine. And so you can actually measure how much protein was being absorbed by the animal prior to having some of that bacterial digestion that happens later on. And still has the issue of it not being humans, but pigs are, of course, closer to humans as far as the digestive tract goes. Another issue, though, here is that they often use raw foods. So they often use like raw legumes, raw grains, and digestibility of those products would actually increase with either processing or cooking because you're going to be removing things like trypsin inhibitors, which are compounds that can block some of the protein digestion. And so that's, again, just another issue there. On top of that, they have the same issue with the limiting amino acid I already mentioned earlier. So that can become a problem, although you can actually create DAS scores for meals, combined meals. So you can measure them for multiple foods. It's just not often done. But again, there are some issues with that sort of scoring system, specifically because of, again, the limiting amino acid problem.
And that scoring system in particular, and some of the limitations of that scoring system, I should say, was summarized by a paper by Joel Craddock here in Australia. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes for anyone who wants to read a little bit further into it. So then where does that leave us? If we're looking at, okay, well, we're saying that these scoring systems have some limitations. They're relying on animal models, rats and pigs. They're looking at feeding in some circumstances of raw legumes. And as you say, when we soak and cook legumes, it increases the protein bioavailability. What science do we have today that gives a more accurate indication as to the differences between the protein in animals and plants when it comes to bioavailability?
Yeah, so we actually have what's called true ileal digestibility. So this is similar to what was done in pigs, where you're basically removing food from, again, the end of the small intestine. But we have that data in humans. We don't have it for a lot of foods because, you know, this hasn't been done a lot, but we do have some data looking at things like soy proteins, pea proteins, wheat gluten, which would be more like a, you know, something like seitan, rapeseed protein, and so on, versus milk proteins, casein, fermented milk. And when we look at the true ileal digestibility in humans, the difference is a few percent at most. It's very, very small here. When we're looking at more isolated or processed or cooked sort of plant proteins. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate into what we would see with things like whole beans, legumes, lentils, and so on, but it gives us an idea that when we're looking at concentrated sources, they are very similar and comparable.
And I think if we take a step back and just go back to what you were saying earlier around how much protein the average person's consuming, and even in the AHS studies, let's say we were to say, look, the early science now is showing there's only a few percent difference, but even if you were to say it was 10%, right? And if the average person requires around 50 grams a day, then with 10% extra, it takes the average person to 55 grams a day, which we know that these populations are consuming.
Yeah, and I think one thing that really gets misunderstood when these sorts of debates and arguments come up is that the recommendations were based on mixed diets. They weren't based on like a carnivore diet, right? So they were based on diets that included plant sources and animal sources of protein. On top of that, when we're having these sorts of discussions about where should your protein come from, we're often talking about, you know, people who are, say, more health conscious, they're eating a largely plant-based diet, whether it is more paleo style or Mediterranean style versus a strictly plant-based diet. You would only be removing certain sources of protein and replacing them with something else. It's not like you're overhauling the entire diet in most cases. If you were typically having a steak and you replaced it with seitan, if anything, you might bump up your protein intake and the absorption there. So if you were to remove eggs and replace them with tofu, you would increase your protein intake per serving or per calorie. And so you can absolutely make these shifts where you're not going to be sacrificing protein quality, quantity, or otherwise.
Okay, so just to summarize this point before we move on and talk about some other aspects of protein and health, what you're saying is that from a protein point of view, protein is made up by these amino acid building blocks. We should not be concerned about missing out on any of these if we're eating a varied diet, even just modestly varied diet with plant-based foods. We're talking fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds as the foundation of one's diet, be it most of their calories or all of them. And then from a bioavailability point of view, you're saying that some of the scoring systems that have been used in the past have perhaps overstated the difference between bioavailability. As it stands today, it looks like it may only be a few percent difference. That's in more isolated forms of protein. More science to come on whole plant protein sources, but there's no real reason to suggest that there's big differences there.
Yeah, and we actually have a very recent study that does touch on that latter point a little bit. Although it was done in pigs, they used more cooked or minimally processed plant foods. They looked at seitan, tofu, soy milk, and then they made sort of like a pea milk kind of product. And they, again, fed it to pigs, measured it the same way. They measured their true ileal digestibility the same way that we're talking about earlier. And the percentage absorption was, or percentage score was like high 90s, mid to high 90s in most cases. Seitan was excellent, and as was tofu and soy milk. So they all performed very well there. They calculated their Diaz scores, and the score dropped due to the, again, limiting amino acid. So it really showcases how the actual bioavailability of those proteins were really good, but when you calculate these scores based on the limiting amino acid, you end up really dropping their values that
way. Which just highlights scoring systems are not always perfect, and they can't always be applied to all populations. Sometimes they are made specifically for a certain population. And I know in Joel Craddock's paper that I mentioned before, he talks specifically around the sort of problems with using DS, particularly if you're trying to apply it to exercise settings. Okay, so having covered all of that, other than the environmental and the ethical reasons that would support a shift from animal protein to plant protein, that's a whole other conversation. Can you speak to why this overall conversation is important from a health point of view? What do we know about animal versus plant protein when it comes to our health outcomes?
Oh man, we have so much data on animal protein intake and whether it be cardiovascular outcomes, all-cause mortality, other chronic disease outcomes, as well as the protective effects of plant protein. And while I'm not going to go through every study here, I've definitely sent you a bunch that you can link down in the show notes, but just a few that I do want to touch on from the last year and a half or so. Start with one really large meta-analysis published in 2020 by Nagishi. I always probably butcher their name, but that's my best try. This was on 31 prospective cohorts, over a million deaths counted. So this had a lot of statistical power, a lot of people included there. And they compared those consuming the highest to the lowest total protein, plant protein, and animal protein separately. And they found those consuming the highest plant protein or total protein had a lower risk of all-cause mortality. So that does in some ways showcase the importance of protein, particularly when it comes from plant sources. It actually reduced risk of mortality, of total death during the study period.
That's a really interesting point for us to just cover, because sometimes there is a bit of fear around having a high protein diet, But what this study is suggesting is that, at least in the populations included in this study, and we can perhaps talk about certain populations where maybe high protein diets are not suitable, but at least what this is suggesting is that protein source is what matters most.
Exactly. And while the plant protein did lead to a lower risk of all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality, I should add, the animal protein did not. That did not have a beneficial effect there. So that, again, just shows why there might be benefit to swapping out the animal protein for the plant protein. And actually, they did a dose response. So they were looking at how much protein would you need to have from plants in order to have some sort of benefit. And just adding 3% of your calories from plant protein lowered risk of all-cause mortality by 5%. So that's just a really tiny increase, and it's a huge opportunity for people to make that shift, especially when we talked about earlier 70 to 85% of their proteins in America anyway coming from animal sources.
So tell me, in terms of that opportunity, and if we sort of drill down, I guess, on specific foods, specific animal foods and plant foods, based on the science, and of course you mentioned there's a bunch of these studies, this is just one, what would some of the best swaps be from a risk reduction point of view if you were saying try and swap this food for this food where you can?
We have actually what are called substitution analyses. So this is when they look at that exact question, right? They want to find out what happens to disease risk or risk of premature death or whatever measurement they're looking at when you replace one food with another, but keep the rest of the diet the same or similar, keep the rest of the lifestyle the same or similar. And one such study was the NIH AARP study from, again, last year, 2020. This had over 400,000 people. It was massive, 16 years of follow-up. And they performed an excellent substitution analysis. They looked at total animal protein, red meat protein, white meat protein, dairy protein, and egg protein, all separately, and what would happen when you replace them with plant protein. And without going through all of it, because there is a lot of data in this particular publication, I do recommend that people check it out if they'd like. They found that for overall risk of mortality, substituting just 3% of calories from total animal protein with plant protein would lower risk by 10% in both men and women. If we looked at red meat specifically, that 3% swap would lead to a 13% lower risk in men and a 15% lower risk in women. For white meat protein, there actually wasn't a statistically significant drop in men, but there was a 5% drop in women. For dairy protein, an 8% drop in men and 8% drop in women. And then for egg protein, it was a substantial 24% drop in men and a 21% drop in women. So these are, again, very small swaps that we're talking about. And what's really important to note about this particular study was they adjusted for fatty acid intake. So they actually adjusted for things like saturated fat intake. So even if you keep the saturated fat intake the same and the polyunsaturated fat intake the same, and we talked more about this in our previous episode, swapping out those protein sources still seems to be beneficial if swapping for plants. And just to fast forward for a second here, a 2021 paper actually looked at specific plant foods being substituted without doing that over adjustment issue, you know, without adjusting for things like saturated fat, and subbing out individual servings of either eggs, processed meat, red meat, or white meat with certain plant sources, be it whole grains, legumes, or nuts and seeds, led to significant drops in risk of cardiovascular or all-cause mortality. And the biggest benefits seem to be when you were replacing some of these animal sources with nuts and seeds in particular.
Hey friends, I hope you're enjoying this episode. It's Simon here. Just a quick intermission to remind you that my book, The Proof is in the Plants, is now available. In this book, I cover common myths about plant-based diets, evidence showing the potential health benefits that are up for grabs, the positive impact eating plant foods has on the planet, and much more. To order your copy, head to plantproof.com/book. plantproof.com/book. Okay, let's get back into it. Okay, there you go. So a lot of information there. If you were to distill that down and provide people with, I mean, the general theme there is there are significant benefits up for grabs with swapping these sources of animal protein for plant protein. And I want to get into what some of the mechanisms are that might be at play there with regards to animal protein. But before that, give me two of your best swaps that you think would be the highest impact swaps for someone to look at today.
I would say swapping processed meat with anything, so with just about anything. Replacing processed meat with something like tofu would be a fantastic swap right there. I would also extend that to unprocessed red meat. I think both of those, definitely swapping them for tofu or other legumes, can be excellent choices. I think for something like eggs, which I believe based on the data we have are probably a lot riskier than most people like to admit. Swapping eggs, again, I can use the tofu example, but even for, you know, things like nuts and seeds at some point can lead to substantial reduction, particularly in that 2021 study. I believe that was one of the largest reductions in risk, if I recall correctly. So those would be a couple examples, but we can talk about a ton of others. Really, anytime you're having these animal proteins, you can sub them for any type of legume is going to be beneficial.
Beautiful. More legumes in the diet being the key there, and that will start to crowd out some of these foods. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the mechanisms at play here. So you spoke about the fact then that some of these studies, they control for other elements in the diet, other nutrients like saturated fat, for example. What is it about animal protein that in and of itself is thought to be perhaps problematic? And going back to the way these studies are being constructed, how do we know that animal protein is not just a proxy for a diet that's richer in saturated fat or heme iron or a diet that lacks fiber, for example?
When you look at these studies, we can kind of assume they're talking about the protein. And there is reason to believe that perhaps. There's certainly speculation about how different amino acid contents of given foods can possibly contribute to disease processes in one way or the other. And maybe that plays a role. I'm actually not super convinced about that being the primary mechanism. I actually do think it's the fact that animal protein intake is an excellent proxy for those other contents found in animal products. When you look at data on just red meat intake as a whole, or even saturated fat intake, there's a lot of issues with a lot of the studies around that. But these substitution analyses in particular seem to do a really solid job of adjusting for these other factors and even removing the impact of saturated fat. So when we look at studies that say adjust for saturated fat, the meat intake, particularly red meat intake, is still a proxy for the heme iron. It's still a proxy for the cholesterol. It's still a proxy perhaps for some of the compounds that are created through cooking of the red meat products. For eggs, one of the reasons I think eggs do so poorly in these substitution analyses is because we've adjusted for saturated fat. We've adjusted for the factor that is going to be more of an issue with meat and less of an issue with eggs. But that exacerbates or emphasizes the issue with dietary cholesterol, because eggs are going to be higher in dietary cholesterol. And so I think at the end of the day, this idea of just following the animal protein is really honing in on these inherent problems with meat. This is inherent because it's not going to change if you're choosing a lean option. If you choose a lean red meat, it's still going to have the heme iron. It's still going to have cholesterol. It might have somewhat less, but remove saturated fat from the picture and there's still a problem there.
So it's about the overall package. Sometimes things can start to be a little complicated when we reduce it down to a single nutrient. It is good to zoom back out and look at the package, what our nutrients are coming with or what they are not coming with. Just on eggs, and this is a sidebar, so to speak, because you mentioned eggs and cholesterol there. And this is, again, a point of confusion online around the impact of dietary cholesterol on cholesterol levels and then risk of cardiovascular disease. Can you give a summary as to the effect of eggs on cardiovascular disease and what science shows is kind of at play there?
One thing that's really important to understand, and I'll plug your book really quick because you talk about this in the book and you've got the nice graphs and everything there. Eating cholesterol from something like an egg increases your LDL cholesterol more, or your ApoB, which is even better marker than LDL cholesterol. We don't need to get into too much. It increases those values most if you don't eat much cholesterol to begin with. So if you took vegans, for example, and you started feeding them eggs, their LDL would shoot up. If you took someone eating a standard American diet and you fed them some eggs, theirs probably wouldn't change all that much, maybe a little bit. And so that's really important to note, that you actually increase your risk more if you're overall eating a pretty healthy plant-centric diet to begin with, if you're to add eggs to it. And so that's just super, super important. And we actually have a meta-analysis from last year showing that eggs do raise LDL pretty reliably when you put all the data together. But I actually suspect there might be more at play than just the dietary cholesterol. For example, the high choline content. Now, genetically elevated choline levels have been associated with type 2 diabetes risk. I think that could be a problem. There's also suggestive evidence, but it hasn't really been put to bed yet, that choline itself may also increase, again, ApoB, which is what makes those LDL particles atherogenic. So there are other mechanisms perhaps at play here, but definitely dietary cholesterol is a problem.
Yeah, it's something I tried to explain in the book. And I think if you refer to that graph in the book, anyone who has a copy, it should make more sense. And you can quickly see how if you design a trial that looks at the additional removal of eggs, but the baseline diet already contains a lot of cholesterol, you can see that it's not really going to affect blood cholesterol levels at all. But if you were to remove all cholesterol from someone's diet, then you would see via the relationship that exists, you can significantly reduce blood cholesterol levels. So if your goal was to get your LDL cholesterol or ApoB down as low as possible, then consuming no cholesterol would be your best bet.
Exactly. And actually a recent study, a massive one, it was like over 500,000 people in the Zhuang 2021 paper, they found that each additional half egg per day increased risk of both, again, all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality by about 7%. But what's really interesting is they did a subgroup analysis. So they looked at those eating low animal protein to begin with, and those eating higher animal protein. And like I said, animal protein is a pretty good proxy for cholesterol intake. Those eating low animal protein had higher risk after including more eggs versus those eating higher animal protein to begin with. So it just really showcases the fact that if you're eating more plant-based to begin with, adding eggs is probably going to have a more detrimental effect.
And it's not that those eating the higher animal protein didn't have increased risk. They just had already increased their risk to a point where it plateaus and the additional cholesterol doesn't make it go up any further.
Exactly. They've already peaked, you know, and then adding more isn't going to do too much after that.
So all of this that we're talking about here, really, it contextualizes what we're talking about, because there are great health benefits up for grabs by adding more plant protein to our plate. And this was where I landed going back to the start of this conversation, when I was going through the information and being challenged. My ideas that I held were being challenged. Ultimately, I saw that there were health benefits up for grabs, and I wanted those. I wanted to reduce my risk of cardiovascular disease in particular going forward. And then naturally, the next question that I was left with was, what about my performance? What about health outcomes with regards to building muscle and strength and being able to still pursue my athletic endeavors? There is a widely held belief that animal protein is superior to plant protein when it comes to these things. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is accurate? And if not, where has this misunderstanding come from?
Well, spoiler alert, I don't think it's really an accurate claim. But where this comes from is, from my experience anyway, and maybe you can point out some other things that individuals will claim, but usually it stems from this idea that beyond the amino acids and bioavailability we already touched on, but that animal protein increases what's called muscle protein synthesis more than plant protein. That is sort of the acute building of muscle tissue that can occur after meals, after working out, and so on. And it is true. Some studies do find that animal protein stimulates MPS, muscle protein synthesis, more than plant proteins. But when you match up their leucine content, the differences in MPS are attenuated. So they're minimized at that point or even gone altogether. So it does showcase the importance for those of us who want to, you know, gain muscle mass, gain strength, to just make sure we're getting enough leucine. And for those who are interested, the target seems to be in the ballpark of 2 to 3 grams per meal of leucine. If you really want to get specific, it's probably about 2.5 to 2.7 grams per meal. But that is certainly possible to do with plants.
Okay, yeah, I would agree with you. I think that most of the sort of basis of this idea that animal protein is superior is, well, it's a few things. I think it definitely stems from the incomplete complete conversation, which we well and truly have tackled now. But yes, certainly there were some earlier studies that did show animal protein was superior for muscle protein synthesis. But we have more recent studies, and maybe you can talk to one or a number of them more specifically, that have looked at plant-based protein against animal-based protein, where they have total protein and leucine equivalent and have shown, you know, the outcomes are the same. And my second part to this question is, what do you think about muscle protein synthesis as a biomarker in the first place?
Yeah, let's actually touch on that latter part first. It is debatable as a marker or a causal marker for muscle building and building strength and muscle mass. In untrained or less trained athletes, it really doesn't seem to correlate much at all. In more highly trained athletes, there may be a correlation there, but that doesn't mean that it is necessarily the be-all end-all. There could be other factors at play. Just because it correlates doesn't mean that is the primary concern that we have. At the same time, like I said, we can match it or pretty nearly match it with plant proteins if getting enough leucine. And actually, a mycoprotein, so this is like a fungal protein found in corn products, so some of you may be aware of those, like mock meat products, have been shown to stimulate equivalent muscle protein synthesis to whey and actually better muscle protein synthesis than milk proteins. So even if it were a concern, even if it was something that we wanted to target and maximize, it can be done by matching leucine content, or it can be done by consuming corn products, apparently. So there's definitely that.
And so with regards to specific clinical trials that have looked at animal-based protein versus plant-based protein and muscle protein synthesis and some of these other markers of performance, what does the science show? What can we make of it as of today?
Well, when we look at actual outcomes, right, the actual strength gains or muscle gains, which is really what we care about when it comes to performance, we actually don't see a difference between animal and plant protein when you're equating the amount of protein, ideally beating that threshold of 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight, and of course, equating leucine. When you've taken care of those issues, there really is no difference. And we have a meta-analysis by Mark Messina actually looking at soy protein and comparing it to whey protein or other animal proteins. And there is no difference. There's not even a suggested difference between the two based on the data we have there. It's pretty well identical. Based on the data we have for either rice protein powders or pea protein powders, it's the same deal. When you're having the same amount of protein, there just doesn't seem to be any kind of difference. There are no issue building the same amount of strength or muscle mass. But the trial that really kind of puts this to bed, in my opinion, was a recent trial published early in 2021. You're actually going to have one of the lead authors on the show shortly, so we don't need to maybe go into super great detail, but we'll touch on the basics here. What they did was they took 19 vegans and 19 omnivores, followed them for 12 weeks while they embarked on resistance training programs. Now, they made sure that both groups were consuming 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And to reach that number in the vegans, they supplemented them with soy protein powders. In the omnivorous group, they supplemented them with whey protein powders. And what's really important about this trial was that, yes, you're getting that protein powder on top of it. But in past trials, people might say, what if it's because they're isolated proteins, they're ground down, they're processed, you're going to have higher digestibility. What if that's why they're equal, but in food form, they aren't? Well, most of the protein for the vegans was coming from foods. Most of the protein for the omnivores in this trial were coming from foods. If there was some kind of difference, I would suspect it to show up in this trial. And, you know, when they're having that 1.6 grams per kilogram and they had 2 to 3 grams of leucine 4 times a day, there were no differences at all in strength or size outcomes. At all, or no statistically significant difference across the board. So this is the one that I think should put to rest the argument, but of course, you know, some will continue to argue beyond that.
So that trial that you just mentioned was with untrained athletes, and I'm sure there may be people thinking, well, what about in trained athletes? Because perhaps the effect of protein, be it animal or plant-based, is different in a trained athlete. Do we have any science that has investigated plant versus animal protein in this type of population?
Yeah, we actually do have some data on pea protein versus whey protein in trained athletes. And again, there wasn't a difference there. But I also want to note that the differences between trained and untrained athletes seem to actually be driven by training volume and intensity. So it just so happens that untrained athletes don't train as hard or as much. So if you do have a trial where you, even if you're taking untrained athletes, but you're having them train a decent amount and at a decent intensity, that difference shouldn't really be relevant.
And the other thing to add there is that regardless of what side of the fence you sit on, most omnivorous bodybuilders or athletes are having a protein shake. You know, one a day is probably a pretty standard intake for someone who is trying to hit this higher protein level. So from my point of view, I don't see anything wrong with including a plant-based protein shake in someone's diet if that's helping them to achieve that total protein intake level, providing that they are consuming a healthy dietary pattern. And of course, food matters a lot. But I think this is an interesting question. Is there any concern over the consumption of protein powders, be it soy pea or other? And the second part of this is, do we need to be concerned about having too high protein intake? Is there any downside to increasing plant protein and perhaps going even above 1.6, 1.8 grams per kilo?
I don't personally think there's a problem with having protein powders at all, really. They can be beneficial, like we've talked about. They can help you hit those protein targets, particularly in more elderly individuals who have higher protein needs. It can help them, you know, maintain some of that mass and prevent some wasting as they age. And it's really satiating. Protein is the most satiating macronutrient, as I mentioned. So from a weight management perspective, it could be beneficial too, if that's something that someone is working on. So I don't see much of an issue there. Now, as far as disease risk, as you've kind of alluded to, am I concerned about high protein intake from plant sources? I'm really not at this point. If anything, the data suggests, we did talk about that one Meta 31 cohorts, the higher total protein intake was actually beneficial as well. I do suspect that there's some kind of ceiling, though. I do suspect that at some point, you're going to be crowding out other foods. We do still want to make sure we're having our fruits and our whole grains and these other really beneficial foods, right? We don't want to crowd out all these foods to the point that you're just having protein or just having protein-rich foods. So as long as it's not sacrificing the variety in your diet, I'm not too concerned.
I think we should probably speak to what the total amount of protein ideally as a threshold is. And so what someone may want to target as a sort of minimum level if they're looking to optimize lean muscle and improve their strength. And then also we could perhaps touch on the protein distribution as well.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, when we were going over the RDAs and everything, for strength athletes, the ideal amount seems to be 1.6 grams per kilogram. That's based on meta-regression from a few years back. And it just really showcased that once you get up above that, the benefit plateaus. You don't seem to benefit by having like 2.5 grams of protein per kilogram body weight or anything. Once you're hitting 1.6, you should be good there. Now, at that level, I think a lot of these other issues that we're talking about, like leucine content, for example, it becomes less of a problem. You're going to be getting enough leucine in the vast majority of cases if you're eating that much protein. But if you do want to be extra concerned, careful about your leucine intake, I mean, soy foods are excellent for that. Adzuki beans, oats can be, although you'll have more calories to get there. Protein powders aren't out of the question at all either. There's no reason not to. Seitan is fantastic for leucine and for total protein, actually. So there are a lot of options there as well. As for the protein timing or spacing of the meals, there is some data suggesting that spreading out your protein intake relatively equally about, say, 3 to 4 times a day, I think in most cases they do 4 times a day, seems to be better for lean mass than is, you know, having a small amount of protein for breakfast and a ton for dinner. But again, these are minor. When it comes to the overall picture, the amount of protein and, of course, the resistance training are going to be the most important factors. That is going to be what we're focusing on most.
And I think that sometimes gets a little lost. We can get very obsessed over the exact number of total protein for the day or leucine and forget how important resistance training is and the volume of training that someone's doing in a week and progressive overload and all of those principles. So I think that shouldn't be understated, that the nutrition component is very important, but you can eat as much protein as you want. And if the resistance training's not there, all that protein doesn't just magically turn into muscle. Let's dig into soy. We spoke about it on a previous episode together. You've just mentioned it there. It is a great source of leucine, and it's a food that I consume regularly in my diet. There are a number of health benefits up for grabs outside of the performance side of things, but it does have a particularly good protein makeup. Now, there is a lot of fear surrounding soy, and often we hear that it causes endocrine disruption and messes with hormones. And this is really something that just keeps coming up over and over and over. And so I think it is important to address it. Can you talk to the science around soy and whether any of this fear is warranted?
Soy is... It's weird. I don't understand where the concern comes from. It's in my opinion, probably one of the most health-promoting foods, most readily available health-promoting foods that we can really consume. Now, this idea that it is, say, estrogenic or going to negatively affect hormone levels, lower testosterone in men and all of that, they come from a couple places. For one, there are some rodent studies where they've isolated these phytoestrogens from soy and fed them in large amounts to the rodents, and they run into problems. And I mean, there's a couple of problems there. Again, we aren't rodents, and we don't consume isoflavones in these massive concentrations. Now, for those listening, isoflavones is really just another word for the phytoestrogens we find in soy. And these phytoestrogens are estrogen-like compounds, we'll say. They mimic the structure in certain ways. They can bind to some of the same receptors, albeit much weaker. They're about, say, 1/100 to 1/1000th the strength of our own endogenous estrogen. So they don't really end up having the same effect and can actually dampen the estrogenic effect in some cases. But those rodent studies is really where a lot of this concern stems from. Now, there are actually a couple case studies, a couple individual men in particular from a while ago. I actually can't remember when they were published, probably a couple decades ago or so, who were consuming ridiculous amounts of soy. Like, they were on pretty much a soy-only diet. If I recall correctly, it was like 14 or more servings of soy a day, which, I mean, I eat a lot of soy and I'm nowhere near that. And they may have run into some issues that may be attributed to the soy. Again, we can't determine cause and effect based on that, but it's possible. And even if it is possible, it was, like I said, a ridiculous amount that they were consuming. But when we look at the actual human data, we find that soy is incredibly beneficial. For women in particular, we see a lower risk of breast cancer. And the reason being is largely because these phytoestrogens, they actually bind to specific receptors in our body, or they prefer to bind to specific receptors that in breast tissue may actually have anti-estrogenic effects. So it may actually combat the estrogen response that we're getting in breast tissue, which would lower breast cancer risk. In men, we see a lower prostate cancer risk. For women, we can also see a lower risk of osteoporosis again, and that may be because we get that estrogen activity in bone tissue, and actually that pro-estrogenic activity in bone tissue where we want it, while we get the anti-estrogenic activity in breast tissue where we don't want it. So it's selective. And if we look at an umbrella review from last, I think it was about a year ago, maybe just over a year ago now, that looked at 114 different meta-analyses, 43 different health outcomes, we do find reduced breast cancer, as I mentioned, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, endometrial cancer, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. It was just on and on and on. And now, not all the data is super rock solid and we can be 100% positive about. What we can be pretty certain about is that there is benefit in some cases, like breast cancer, for example. And at worst, there just doesn't seem to be any reason to think there's risk.
Yeah, which is at odds with the narrative that you often see online, right? The amount of fear that is generated from those rat studies and the case studies often is sort of used as a... It becomes false equivalence to the stronger evidence that we have. What about studies looking specifically, and you may have mentioned it there, or perhaps I didn't catch it, but studies looking specifically at soy and its effect on hormones in males and females?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. I don't think I touched on that. There is, from just December, very recent, a new meta-analysis looking at randomized controlled trials of either soy or isoflavone, again, phytoestrogen feeding. And they found no impact at all on male testosterone or estrogen levels. If anything, they actually did a second analysis where they looked at just those consuming the most of the isoflavones. And if anything, it almost trended towards a higher testosterone level. So again, I'm not going to claim it raises your testosterone levels, but certainly not reason for concern. And on top of that, we do have data on women. There was a meta-analysis back in 2009, and there wasn't any real change in estrogen levels. There were some small changes in some secondary hormones, FSH and LH for those who are interested. But those are the sorts of hormones that will lead to either production or suppression of the, like say, estrogen, for example. So when we're looking at the hormones of concern, like estrogen, like testosterone, and so on, it just, again, doesn't seem to be at all a concern. And when we look at the actual health outcome data, which is what matters, again, lower risk of breast cancer, lower risk of other forms of cancer, we actually see potential protection or reduction in menopausal symptoms. So that'd be, if anything, benefit there. So yeah, not something I would at all be concerned about.
And all of that is wrapped up and summarized in the major guidelines, for example, the American Cancer Society, the Dietitians of Canada. These societies, in their guideline papers, they make it very clear that soy can be part of a healthy diet that's rich in whole plant foods. And their recommendation is to hold off on isoflavone supplements being different to soy in its whole food, tofu and soy milk and tempeh, etc., just until there is more research on those supplements, which is really the case with many new supplements that sort of surface. And so I think the take-home message there is, if you want to include soy in your diet, there are potentially some great benefits up for grabs. It's a great source of protein. And on the flip side, if you're allergic or for some reason you just don't want to consume soy, it's also not essential. There are plenty of other ways to get protein in a plant-based diet.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, lentils, beans, chickpeas, seitan, as we mentioned, there's so many other options out there.
Hey friends, me again. Quick note to let you know, I have a brand new, completely complimentary 2-week plant-based meal plan on my website. Inside contains delicious breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack recipes, along with a complete breakdown of the nutritional information for each. Whether you're looking to add one plant-based meal to your weekly regime or go full plant, I'm sure you'll find this resource helpful. You can get your copy today at plantproof.com/meal plan. That's plantproof.com/meal plan. Okay, let's get back into it. The other food that I'd like to chat about here, because it can often be quite a good protein source, is plant-based meat alternatives. And I know that recently you wrote a fantastic review on exactly this. I will put that review into the show notes as well. I think anyone who's interested in this should take a read. You know, Matt, often online, I see this image on social media where it has, and you will have seen this, it has the beef on one side and it has Beyond Burger on the other, or some other type of plant-based meat alternative. And usually below it, it has a list of ingredients. And the longer list of ingredients on the plant-based alternative is being used as a way of scaring people from consuming that food. Now, I know that you like to go to the science, and what you care more about is not necessarily the ingredient list, but what are the health outcomes? How does this food affect our health? Can you speak to this?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, I think, almost ridiculous argument that I see a lot, because by that standard, you can make a lot of really healthy things seem unhealthy. I mean, fortified soy milk, for example, or fortified any milk, pick a plant milk. If it's fortified, it's going to have all of this added nutrition. And all those, you know, or most of those things you see on the ingredients list are just going to be nutrients. And somehow that's supposed to mean it's all of a sudden unhealthy. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. At the same time, I could take a glass of water, squeeze some lemon in there, throw some mint leaves, and all of a sudden, is it less healthy than if I had just water alone because it has more ingredients? It's so ridiculous. And so, again, it comes back to health outcomes or at least really good markers for disease outcomes. And how do these foods affect those? And I think that is where we should be looking, not necessarily just the number of ingredients that it has.
And so have we seen any studies that speak to that? How do we know that, for example, a plant-based burger is a healthier option to the burger that it's replacing?
Yeah, so we actually do have one. Actually, we have a couple studies I could point to, but one really good one that came out about a year or so ago was the Swap Meat study. This was a randomized crossover trial where they had, you know, a group of participants, 36 participants. They were randomized into two groups. One group we'll call the Beyond Meat group, and then the other group was just the Standard Meat group. And now the Beyond Meat group had two or more servings of Beyond Meat products per day for 8 weeks, while the meat group had not just meat, but two or more servings of organic meat products per day for 8 weeks. So I want everyone to just realize that this, you know, an argument that you would get otherwise is, oh, it wasn't organic, it wasn't, you know, grass-fed, whatever. Like they were choosing what would be considered higher quality by most standards, or most people's standards, I should say. And so they followed their diets for 8 weeks. The rest of their diet stayed the same. And then they swapped and they followed the opposite diet for another 8 weeks. And at the end of that period, we actually see that the Beyond Meat group did better with regard to a few markers, at least. They had lower LDL cholesterols, again, indicating lower cardiovascular disease risk. They actually lost a little bit of weight. I believe it was around 1 kilogram, which is nothing to write home about. But again, this was such a minor dietary shift here. It wasn't like they were overhauling their entire diet. They were just replacing meat with Beyond Meat. And again, there was just no reason to think that they were worse off eating the Beyond Meat products. They were doing as well or better when we're looking at the markers. At the same time, if we look at Beyond Meat and compare it to, say, a standard beef burger, we're going to see less saturated fat, obviously less cholesterol because there's none. We're going to see actually more iron, about double the iron that you would get otherwise, although it is a different form, and we can talk about that. Higher calcium content. So there's actually a lot there that we can look at as beneficial.
So it really pays, I guess, to come back to compared to what? What are these products replacing in someone's diet? If they're replacing a standard beef burger, sort of 80% lean burger, which is probably one of the more common types, then moving to the plant-based burger that is lower in saturated fat, contains zero dietary cholesterol, has a very similar amount of protein in most cases, contains more fiber, and as you said, in some cases, more micronutrients, is a step in the right direction and could lower their risk of various diseases. At the same time, you're not arguing that these foods are better than eating beans. So context is key here, but I just think it's worth sort of speaking to the fact that sometimes we see these comparisons online and you see that long list of ingredients, and the idea there is to paint that as a bad food, but that's not really the case. We have to go to the science. We have to look at compared to what.
Yeah, always. And that's the point I wanted to make here is when we're talking about these plant-based meat alternatives, we're usually not talking about someone replacing their lentils with a burger. Usually we're talking about someone who would otherwise be replacing a beef hamburger with a plant-based version.
And I can imagine that these products perhaps have some utility in different populations. So whether it is this sort of person who's consuming a lot of calories, a lot of fiber already, has a high protein target, and these are a sort of lower fiber plant-based food that's high in protein that could help achieve that goal. And then also in the elderly type of populations, there may be an advantage for certain people to work some of these plant-based meat alternatives into their diet to hit that slightly higher protein requirement. And again, it depends on their baseline diet and their circumstances. But as you mentioned earlier, there is a slightly higher protein intake as someone's sort of approaching 65 years of age and beyond to reduce the risk of sarcopenia.
Yeah, and you don't need to go for like the Beyond Burger or the Impossible Burger, which are designed to very closely mimic, you know, standard meat and you know, as such, they have higher saturated fat contents, you can actually get low saturated fat options too that would be better for your cardiovascular risk profile as well.
To wind this one up, let's conclude with some take-home messages and practical tips to incorporate more plant protein into one's diet, and perhaps speak to what one could expect to feel in the short term and the health benefits in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about this last time too, but I'll kind of bring it up again, is my sort of approach to those looking to transition or swap out, you know, certain foods for the others is actually to do exactly that. Look at these individual simple swaps that you can do. You know, if you're used to having a pasta with meat sauce, maybe if you want to get a high protein source, you do the pasta with tomato sauce and ground tofu in there, or lentils in the sauce to give it that sort of meaty kind of texture. That's one. Obviously, if you're having dairy milk, sub it for soy milk. It's fantastic, high protein source, about 7 grams a cup. So you can get a decent dose that way. If you're ever looking to use things like chicken in a stir fry, soy curls are fantastic. I know I posted on Instagram the other day and you went and ordered a whole bunch.
I did. Yeah. I got a whole bunch coming over.
Yeah. They're amazing. Anybody who hasn't tried them, all you do is you soak these dry soy curls, and they are just soy. That's the only ingredient. You soak them for like 10 minutes. They plump up into this meaty texture, and then you cook them up whatever way you want. And then actually, I'm going to probably make some tonight.
I feel like, are they a new food that's entered the market, or have they just gone viral? Because I feel like everyone's talking about soy curls right now.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea where they came from. I just remember I actually had a gift card for a new plant-based little shop that opened up here, and I just wanted to use it. And I was like, oh, I'll try those out. And then I got addicted. So that's really what happened. But they're fantastic. As far as swaps, actually another one, this one is one that I don't think is mentioned enough, is if you're used to eating something like rice or any kind of grains with your foods, swap it for quinoa. Quinoa is actually a decent little protein source. You get about 8 grams per cup, or about, if you want to look at per calories, 3.7 grams per 100 calories. So it adds a little bit on top of that as well. And one of my favorites of late are legume-based pastas. I love these. I love the red lentil pastas. I use those a lot. And one particular brand I get, Explore Cuisine, I calculated it out. It's just over 20 grams per 100 gram serving, which works out to about 6 grams per 100 calories. So, you know, if you're normally having pasta and you swap it for that, you're going to really jack up your protein intake. And actually, if you get the edamame pastas, it's even, you know, far more. It's almost twice as much protein as that too. So it's really a huge dose there.
Yeah, the legume pastas get a good run in my kitchen as well, that's for sure. And in terms of benefits, we have covered the long-term benefits quite comprehensively in terms of if you're replacing animal foods, and particularly the ones you went through before, with these plant-based sources of protein, there's lower risk of cardiovascular disease and a bunch of other chronic diseases, and in all likelihood, increasing the number of years lived, hopefully, overall. What about short-term benefits? What could someone expect to experience as they're making these changes?
Now, this isn't an area we have a ton of research. We do have, you know, some anecdotal experiences we can talk about a little bit. But as far as more evidence-based suggestions I can give, or, you know, claims I can make here, is particularly if, you know, someone is dealing with like constipation, for example, increasing the fiber intake can have some benefits there for more regular bowel movements, for example. Now, if you're someone who is jacking up your fiber intake too much or too fast, and that's leading to some gut upset, there are ways around that as well. You use some of the more minimally processed protein foods, like we mentioned the tofu, we mentioned seitan, we've mentioned those legume pastas. I think those can fit in there really well. But you can also soak legumes overnight prior to cooking, and that may help with some of the abdominal discomfort in the short term. Over the course of a few months, that should wane anyway if someone does experience that. Now, other benefits in the short term is a lot of people, I know myself included, more energy. I tend to feel like I have more energy, particularly after meals. I believe you mentioned something like that as well. But you know, easier digestion would be another one. But I'm not sure. Do you have anything else to add to that?
I think short term, the biggest difference for me was just a general feeling of being lighter and more energetic after my meal. So it was more in that sort of 1 to 2 hours after eating the meal, I just didn't feel as kind of, ugh. and didn't feel like I needed to sit down on the couch and just felt lighter overall. I feel like the food moves through a bit quicker and digests a little bit more easier and almost feels like it requires less energy. Now, again, that's anecdotal, but that was certainly one of the first things that I experienced as I was cutting out foods like red meat in favor of foods like lentils and other legumes. You mentioned soaking, Matt, and I know that you've referenced a study before and you have some specific tips around soaking overnight and sort of, you know, how many hours we should be considering if we're wanting to make legumes more digestible. Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, so the reason that some people will get like bloating or gas after having a meal of legumes is because of actually three indigestible compounds that we consume in those foods. They're known as verbascose, raffinose, and stachyose. Now, we don't digest them, but some of our gut microbes do. And when they break those down, they'll produce gas. So what we can do is we can soak them. And we do have data looking at different amounts of time for soaking. I believe the shortest I've seen is either 6 or 8 hours. And then there's 12 hours and 16 hours at the long end. It seems that 12 hours is pretty darn solid at really reducing the amounts of those compounds in there, but 16 is actually a little bit better. So if someone's really struggling to digest those foods, definitely limiting the amounts at a given meal. So starting with small servings and slowly building up over time can be beneficial, but I would recommend trying to soak for about 12 to 16 hours prior to cooking them and making sure, of course, you remove the water before cooking.
Perfect. So start small and build up slowly, get some momentum. Cool. All right, Matt, thank you so much for coming on and tackling this topic with me. I'm sure this will be a massive hit. And as I said at the start, it is the episode I wish I had 6+ years ago. But anyway, better late than never. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing and teaching us so much again. And as always, would love to have you back on again soon.
Happy to anytime. Always a pleasure.
There we go. Feel a little better now about upping your plant protein? I hope you do. Even if it's just a few times a week, swapping red meat for lentils, tofu, or beans. Start small, but start today, because getting started is quite literally the hardest part. I remember when I first started transitioning to a plant-based approach, one of the first steps I took was to learn how to make a really delicious tofu scramble. What a great step that was. Speaking of my personal experience, something I would like to add to this conversation is my own experience with plant protein. And, you know, I'm not huge on personal anecdotes because ultimately there are anecdotes to support all sides, all versions of a story. But for what it's worth, I have been able to build considerable muscle and strength eating only plants for over 6 years. So I know it's absolutely possible. Once those amino acids are in your blood, the body isn't interested if they came from animal or plant tissue. They are all the same by that stage. I thought of an analogy today to help explain this. It's kind of like this. Imagine you order 20 light bulbs to install in your new living room. When they arrive, half are in one packaging and the other a different package. And you realize that half have a country of origin in Spain and the other half Canada. The packaging is slightly different and the way the box opens is also a little different. But once you take them out of their boxes, which is equivalent to amino acids entering your blood, the lights all look exactly the same. Each connects to the light fitting, and each shines bright when you flick the switch. The fact some of the lights came from Spain and others from Canada is irrelevant. And while there are rumors that the Spanish light bulbs are not as good, they shine just as bright and last just as long. Those rumors are really only alive because the Canada light bulb manufacturers have done such a great job marketing their products, just as the animal agriculture industry has done marketing theirs. Feel free to share that analogy far and wide, adapt it as you see fit. Maybe it will come back to me like a boomerang with a new shape. That would be cool. Also, be sure to reach out to Dr. Matthew Nagra on Instagram at dr.matthewnagra and continue today's conversation. I know he would absolutely love to hear from you. Lastly, before I do let you go, I have a book recommendation. I get asked all the time about my favorite books. I read a lot of books, and I have an absolute classic for you today, The Alchemist. It fell into my hands again randomly this week, quite literally just turned up on my doorstep. So if somebody ordered that for me, thank you. I decided I would read it again. This is probably now the fourth or the fifth time, and every time I get something new out of it. Young Santiago, I can't get enough of this boy's story. If you haven't read it, please do yourself a favor. It is one of the most wonderful books I've read to this day. It is a magical use of the written word, and it will leave you feeling uplifted and inspired to pursue your dreams no matter what they are. So if that sounds like something of interest to you, if it's speaking to you, then check it out and let me know what you think. I'll leave you with that. Thanks again for hanging out with me. I look forward to catching you in a few days for the next Wednesday Wisdoms episode. This one is on longevity lessons with Dan Buettner of the Blue Zones. Until then, remember, more plants, my friends, more plants.